Welcome to the Shelf Shedding Movie Show. I'm your host, Jason Dubray, and I'm really excited. This is episode 80, believe it or not, and my guest returning, it's been a little while, but returning to the show, Sky Brandon, and I looked it up because I had actually forgotten the number. We had you on to talk about the Best Picture nominees of 1994, which were all really amazing movies, and that was episode 28. So that doesn't feel that long.
Well, we've been planning this one for ages, and then did it, and then someone got I'd get busy and like go away, and like, oh yeah, we'll plan it when I get back. So it's my fault.
Making great theater all over Canada and the world. I think that's a pretty noble reason to wait on a little while for a podcast there. And I also want to mention, like, this show is going to be a sequel of sorts. At the time when we lost the great Canadian actor Christopher Plummer, I was, understandably, as we all were, even though, I mean, he made it to his 90s for sure, but still, we were saddened by it. And so I actually created two tribute shows. The first one was episode 35, so 45 episodes ago. It covered six movies with Tom Ratzlaff. And now this is the second one. We're going to be talking about late career Christopher Plummer. And he was a guy who, I think he was great all along, but he seemed to get better with age. It just seemed to be that way. But a big reason, Sky, that I wanted to have you on for the Christopher Plummer tribute show is because, unlike myself, you actually had some encounters and met Christopher Plummer through Stratford. So I don't know if you'd like to share those at the beginning, but welcome back to the show. I'm so excited to be talking with you tonight.
Pleasure to be here with you, my friend, and that we're finally doing it after various messages over the past few years.
Yeah, that happens for sure. So what... I guess maybe you start off before you had the opportunity to meet him, but when did you first become aware of Christopher Plummer?
I guess I knew he's the guy from Sound of Music, but like I didn't clock him in terms of like that's the actor who plays the part. Like I remember watching, for example, Glory and then Lean on Me, and like I immediately then knew who Morgan Freeman was in everything that I saw him in, right? I think with Plummer, like it really was like, oh, that's that guy. Like it might have even been 12 Monkeys. In terms of just when I was then starting to think of like, hey, I would like to be an actor. And so I just started paying attention to like, because, you know, he was off doing primarily theater for a while. It's not that he stopped making movies, but then when I saw 12 Monkeys, I'm like, oh, he's the guy who did this, this, and this when he was younger. And then from that point on, I just would go watch stuff because Christopher Plummer was in it.
I mean, I think I might not be completely kind to all the movies we're talking about, but I'm not sure that he gives a bad performance in any one of these movies, nor in much. I mean, I can't off the top of my head think of, like, sometimes he's giving a big performance, but not necessarily a bad performance.
Right.
And yeah, when I grew up, I actually didn't know he was the guy from Sound of Music. I didn't watch The Sound of Music a whole lot growing up. Other people in my family did. And then I was like, oh, that couldn't be him. He's always been this old man or something. I always thought of him as this old man. And I'm trying to remember, there was a Canadian TV show he was on. I think it was on CTV. And that's where I think he was like a supporting actor in it or something, secondary character. But I would see clips of that pop up, and that's when I first knew that face. I didn't know that this is like a great, great actor. And that was my first, and then I started seeing him in movie after movie after movie. And then as I got into theater, I realized, okay, this guy is one of the greats around the world, but he also never really forgot Canada. And I think that's impressive because, and I'm not sure, maybe it's unfair criticism that sometimes people go down to the U.S. and then they don't come back as much, or they don't refer to Canada as much. I think it's still sort of there. We sometimes don't see it as much as we did. But we're going to be talking about a totally Canadian movie. It is set in the U.S., but a Canadian-made film that he did, you know, and I think it was his late 80s. And, yeah. You know, he he would come back and he would perform at Stratford. And he didn't have to do that. He didn't have to do that. I mean, his legacy was set, but he wanted to. He wanted to not just have the New York and London, but he also wanted Canadian theater to be noticed around the world too. So that's
And Stratford is where he kind of got his big start. Like when he got asked to play Henry V, not many people knew who he was before then. Like within certain circles they did, but once he got to play Henry V at Stratford, that changed his trajectory.
Remember, which is something
he never forgot, right? Like that's why he came back.
Well, and I remember, and well, briefly when we review one of the movies mentioned Prospero, but when he performed The Tempest, he said, "This is the retirement project for a lot of actors, but I'm not anywhere close to retiring, so don't worry about that. The last thing I do, I have a lot more to do." And he did have a lot more to do after that. His movie work, you know, do you feel that there was a difference between his theater work and his movie work?
No, not, you know, like there's, of course, like there's this, the technical element of like, oh, you have to be able to be heard. So in terms of just sheer volume, but what I always admired about him and getting to watch him, those few seasons that he came back at Stratford at the end, which I got to watch him do those shows. We were never on the same track, so I never got to be in a show with him, but he did come to see, you know, he came and saw our production of Titus, and yeah, I think he came and saw the Midsummer Night's Dream that I was in as well. And, but then I got to watch him. It seemed effortless. Like you could always hear him, but he didn't have to work hard. So it just gave this really not illusion, but just this ability to, oh, he's just talking to me, even though I'm in an 1800 seat thrust stage at the festival. That's something I always admired, someone who can reach the back of the hall but not make it seem like they're working hard to do it.
He's not screaming, he's not yelling. No. Sounds like a person who's naturally talking, and that is so hard to do.
That's incredible. If the character asks, you know, and demands, and then, you know, all of a sudden the scene, the character is getting worked up and raises his voice, of course, but it's not like, why, God, he's just shouting the whole time to be heard. He's like, no, he knew his instrument, had been using it for many, many decades, great at what he did, and he could just stand there on the stage and everyone was transfixed.
And I mean, I've watched staged or filmed performances, live performances, from him, but I was never in the audience to see him act. So that's, I mean, that alone is amazing to be able to see that and learn from that.
But then in some of the movies we're going to talk about too, you know, in a number of them, there would be scenes though where he does get goofy, like physically, like, so you get to see him cut loose a little bit. He's not just always stoic and standing still and listen to my beautiful voice. Like, he had a lot of fun.
I feel some people for a while thought of him as, I think there might've been some people out there who thought he was British. Ian McKellen and people like that. But that he would do like stuffy costume dramas, but that was not him at all. And it was just suddenly like when he's in his 80s, people started to pay attention to him again. And he just got this series of great roles all of a sudden. I don't know if it was maybe The Insider that was part of that, or if it was kind of building up, you know, throughout the 90s and for the rest of his life.
Well, and it kind of goes hand in hand, I think, because like I remember too, like by that point, you know, when 12 Monkeys kind of hit for me, and I'm like, oh, that's that guy. But that's right around the time where then after that he ended up doing Barrymore on Broadway and won the Tony, and then he was in Hair at the Wind with Brian Dennehy. You know, he played King Lear, that was based on the Stratford production, and bulk of the product team came down and they moved to Broadway, and that kind of, oh yeah, right, Christopher Plummer. Like, so it's interesting that the late part of his career, just from an outsider's perspective, it just seems like the theater and the film was always going hand in hand. One fed the other. It's okay, I did this for a little while and that kind of got me this opportunity, but now I'm going to leverage that to do this. And now that I'm going to go back to Stratford and we're going to, you know, sell some tickets, 'cause now I've got some buzz come out of this and this, or.
Yeah. I mean, that was great. And not everybody gets that kind of a third act to their career. Yeah. And I'm really glad that he did. Do you have any stories? I think at times in the past you told me a couple of them, but any stories of talking to him or running into him?
Yeah, well, two. I can speak of two. Like when I went to Stratford myself, it was to join the conservatory. So I went in the fall of 2008, knowing that I was going to be offered roles in 2009. And when I got there, that's when he had come back to do Caesar and Cleopatra, the George Bernard Shaw show. Yeah. So he was there performing it when I arrived and was able to see it. And then Martha Henry, who's now has recently passed, past couple of years here, she was the head of the conservatory. And so on a Sunday following a 2 o'clock matinee, he came in after he had just finished the show, and he was supposed to just going to come in for an half an hour and talk to the six of us and we could ask him questions. Well, we all stayed for like almost 2 hours. He just kept talking. So it was like the six of us and Martha and Ann Stewart, who was kind of like the stage manager coordinator for the conservatory. And so we ended up having this really great candid conversation with him, and he was really open about his career. And like when he was like, yep, I had to stop drinking, like he got really open about like, no, this was a lesson I learned and I had to start approaching the work differently. And yeah. And doing so in a really great raconteur manner, right? He's telling a great story while he's doing all this. Mm-hmm. So that was my first experience with him, other than watching him in the show, was we got to hang out with him for 2 hours and just sit down and chat in the rehearsal hall. Yeah. The other one was very shorter, was a lot shorter. Well, he came and saw Titus. That was a fun one. I offered him one of the meat pies at the end of Titus, and he just said, no, dear boy, I know what's in that pie. And so he refused to eat it. But personally, I reached out through Martha. I wanted to ask him. I've been reaching out to a few people. Douglas Rain was another one of them, where I wanted to pick his brain about Henry V. Mm-hmm. And Prince Hal from the Henry IV plays, and that transition into Henry V. And I asked Martha, do you think he'd be willing to chat? And she's like, well, let me see what I can do. And this would have been when he came back to play Prospero. So that would have been my third season. So he was in Tempest, and then I was in Richard III and Titus. And I just got an email from Martha saying, like, after his matinee today, go to his dressing room at, you know, be there at 5 p.m., knock on the door. And I knew who his dresser was. He's like, he's gonna let you in. And yeah, and so he signed a copy of his book for my mom so I could give it to my mom for her birthday. And we sat there and had about a 15-minute chat in his dressing room about Henry V. And of course he was like, I can't remember much about it. Of course, it was a long time ago, but just the fact that he would not only carve out time for me, but then he would do it after he finished playing Prospero. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I just get the sense he was a good guy. I mean, he wanted to give back to the next generation of theater
like
artists.
He didn't suffer fools. Like, let me say that. Like, sure. If people were like goofing around, or he thought wasting his time in rehearsals, he would fucking call him on it. I heard enough stories from friends who were in shows with him. So, wasn't all like teddy bear and roses, but
no. And I almost see that in his characterizations, like, and even, and we'll be talking about certainly, you know, a couple villains in here on the surface, but they always have a little bit of a smile. There's a smile and a charm, but there's this other side. And I mean, that I think that was all in him, and he could relate to the heroes, but he could also he could play the villains very well. And I initially I thought he was more of a character actor doing villain work in his TV and and his movie work. And, you know, I know Dolores Claiborne was part of the first show that we did as a tribute to him in 12 Monkeys. And yeah, anyway, I just think he's an extraordinary man, and we're very proud that he's Canadian. 2021, I believe, is when he passed. And so, yeah, doesn't feel that long ago, but I'm happy we get to pay tribute to him. So these are the movies that we're going to chat about. The lightest one, oddly enough, is the one that he won his Oscar for, Mike Mills' movie Beginners. So we'll start with that. Then it gets fairly intense after that. go to this nice little 1999 film called The Insider, directed by this low-known director named Michael Mann that some people may have heard of. And his co-star is some hack named Al Pacino. So, and of course, Mr. Russell Crowe. This was his
first
nomination. I am a leading man, take me seriously. So then we're going to look at, again, the Canadian movie I alluded to, directed by Adam McGoyan, one of the most famous contemporary Canadian filmmakers remember. Then we'll look at The Last Station, where he gets to go back and forth with Helen Mirren, and also has Paul Giamatti, who's obviously this year very important in the Oscar race, and James McAvoy, and an actor I really love, Carrie Condon's in there as well, among others. And then Syriana, which is a big movie. It's not the longest movie we're talking about, but there's a lot of ideas in it.
Yeah.
And this is probably arguably, if somebody was going to criticize a movie that isn't necessarily a Christopher Plummer movie, but this is like a true ensemble, because this is the movie George Clooney won his Oscar for. But I wouldn't say it's George Clooney's movie either. I mean, there's...
No, and his award was for supporting actor. It wasn't lead. It's one of those films where they often, when they promoted it, I remember them talking about the script as the star, where it really isn't a true ensemble.
I think everybody's a supporting actor. That's always an interesting term, supporting actor. The lead actor supporting all the other actors too. But yeah, in that case, I mean... huge ensemble cast, big movie. We won't be able to cover all of it, probably. You know, it'd be like when I reviewed Robert Altman's Shortcuts. You can only focus on certain aspects of that. And then we're going to end off the movie where he became, and still to this day, the oldest acting Oscar nominee, Ridley Scott's All the Money in the World. And that has a lot of almost more interesting stuff about the backstory and behind the scenes than the movie itself, but the movie itself is interesting enough as well. So anything else you'd like to say before we start reviewing Beginners?
No, let's jump in.
Arthur, you're coming to live with me now, okay? That's the bathroom. This is the living room. This is the dining room where people come and eat sometimes.
Look, it's lonely out here, so you better learn how to talk with me. This is 2003. This is what the sun looks like, and the stars. This is the president. And this is the sun in 1955, and the stars, and the president. My parents got married in 1955. They had a child, and they stayed married for 44 years until my mother died. 6 months later, my father told me he was gay.
I'm gay.
I remember him wearing a purple sweater when he told me this, but actually he wore a robe.
I'm gay.
He was gay the whole time they were married. Oliver. I just met a girl.
You point, I'll drive.
This way?
Hello?
Oliver?
Yeah?
They had some wonderfully loud music in the club tonight.
Insane, insane, insane. What kind of music's that?
Probably house music.
Yeah. House music. Okay. House music.
The bronchoscopy revealed a mass.
Well, let's not rush out and tell everyone.
Sometimes I wonder.
Before Anna, I had four serious relationships. I let all of them fall apart.
Just be happy about it, huh?
The melody.
For the first time I saw, I'm really in love.
And I am once again with you.
People like us, half of them think things will never work out. The other half believe in magic.
And each kiss an inspiration.
Sex, life, healing, nature, magic.
The memory of love's refrain.
This is what I'm supposed to feel like. Yeah, me too.
My experience with Beginners, written and directed by Mike Mills, and I sense a very personal movie from this guy. I think he was pretty young when he did it. Is when I first saw it, there was so much buzz about Christopher Plummer's performance. It was almost like he was crowned the best supporting actor before the movie even came out. And yet it was a kind of a small indie type of a film. And it's about essentially his son, played by Ewan McGregor, is the star, trying to deal with the fact that his, it's not a spoiler, it's right at the beginning, that his father has died. His mother died some years before, after his mother died, and his father was about 75. He came out of the closet, and then he totally embraced being a gay man in gaining you know, connected with causes and all kinds of groups in LA. And then we're kind of going back and forth between flashbacks of his father and the years leading up to, you know, him getting sick and how that's handled. And then he meets a woman at a costume party that his friends have dragged him out to because he's sad about his father dying, understandably. And he meets the wonderful, I think, underrated actor, Melanie Laurent. And this really interesting and I think kind of down-to-earth love story happens. And we're kind of in Ewan McGregor's head for a lot of the film. Like, mm-hmm. things will happen in the present, and then he'll think back to an incident with his father, or farther back, an incident with his mother, and how those two really strong, interesting figures have shaped who he is now, insecurities and all. Mm-hmm. I think I expected a lot of it the first time I saw it, and it was, to me, it felt like I like it. It's like a 3-star type of movie. I wasn't sure it was my favorite Christopher Plummer performance, but he won the Oscar nonetheless. And I was happy for him because, I mean, just after this career, that's great. The second time I saw it, I saw it once before and was writing a few more notes at that time. It worked for me way more. I would say what worked on that day was I actually started to see myself in the Ewan McGregor character, just where I am, and not too much different in whatever it was a year or so ago that I last saw it. And then watching it again, I think I reached kind of a happy medium. It wasn't as impactful as my second time, but it's still a very good film. And I think everything was about Christopher Plummer, but the screenplay is pretty solid. There's some things that are a little bit choppy until you get to the style of the piece, but there's some really brilliant things going on in this little movie. And to me, 3 outstanding performances. And I think the other 2 are great as well. But what's fun, I think, for Christopher Plummer is, I mean, he gets to be a character who's 75 years, and we see a few years where he's living his true self, and he's not in the closet, and he feels totally free, and he's making up for lost time, and he's really living his life. But he's concerned because he sees his son is almost like he was, not living his life and not you know, embracing everything about it, and he kind of wants that for him. There are bits that get me choked up with this movie, and I think, you know, intentionally so. But it doesn't feel like, even though it did win Best Supporting Actor, for your consideration, let's play the sad music and try to superficially bring us to tears. I think it's just really the honesty of it and the performances and how much you fall in love with these characters as we go along. There's also a really cute Jack Russell dog.
Yeah. That is steals almost every scene. Yeah,
not completely from Plummer, but it could. So some people who are dog lovers might argue that that Jack Russell gives the best performance. So, it's a very positive one. It's not my favorite of the ones we're talking about, but it's up there for me. What are your thoughts on Beginners?
I found it was like when I was rewatching and some of them I had not watched yet until we talked about this, doing this episode eventually. Yeah. So while I did rewatch some of them in anticipation of finally sitting down to record, when I first watched them was because we had planned this, and this was one of them. I hadn't actually watched it when it first came out. And I appreciated when I was doing the rewatch of these leading up to our time here today. I'm like, yeah, it really is different from all the other ones. So it ended up feeling like a really breath of fresh air in that the tone is different, the way it's edited, the way it cuts, not just like the flashbacks, but even just musically and composition. It was a great movie to watch, like the way it cuts in with like images and photographs of the past, like, you know, this was my dad in this time, and this is what this looked like in this year. So it was a style of the film that I appreciated as well. And I think, again, this is just my opinion, sometimes, right, the weight of something that came before affects the next year's thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was nominated the year right before this, 2009, with Last Station, which we're going to talk about later, and did not win for that. But then I wonder if I feel like, oh, wow, like because of the buzz that that created and you roll into the next thing, then all of a sudden that just kind of picks up people and carries it along. So I agree in that, you know, it might not be my favorite film of the six we did. And even though he won the Academy Award, it's not actually my favorite performance of his within the six. Mm-hmm. But I still like it very, very much. Similar to, like, I know we're going to talk about later, but like, you know, Russell Crowe wins Best Actor for Gladiator. And it's like, well, I think that's in the wake of because he was nominated for Insider and didn't get it. And you just kind of carries that over and you end up kind of giving the person the award for something maybe not for the one that they should have been recognized for.
Yeah.
So I wonder if a little bit of that happened because they were in back-to-back years.
I also wonder sometimes what happens is they're thinking, oh, he's getting up there.
We better recognize
him. We better honor him before it's too late. They didn't realize that he would have, you know, still several years of work. I think when we talk about the other ones, and as I get older, I don't know if you're finding this with films in particular, I'm starting to appreciate subtle performances more. So then when I was younger, it had to be kind of flashy or big. And I thought, mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's the better acting because I can see all of this colorful stuff that's happening. It's all there and it's well within his range to play big, as we know from the other movies we're going to be talking about for Plummer. But he's restrained. He holds it back. It's in facial expressions. It's in body language. It's just how he delivers a line. They have that bit where they cut it about three different times for these memories, which whether they're false memories of Ewan McGregor's or not, where he's wearing different outfits. I imagine it's this color, but it wasn't actually this. It was this outfit. And each one of those lines is read a little bit different, but it still seems similar. That's kind of tricky to do. I think, you know,
when I see bits like that, I always wonder how many times that he did it. How many times did he do that line that day?
And then they had to do 10 to 20 takes
with of one each outfit.
And then he had to do another 10 to 20 with the next one. You know, and make
and
it
then the editor is like, I can't even tell the difference anymore. I don't know what's going on.
I just think it's terrific. And maybe that was the first time I saw it. I was kind of through the lens of, oh, I'm expecting something that's super emotional or super flashy. And it wasn't that, but it was exactly right for this film. Same with Ewan McGregor. Sometimes I think he can get criticized when he plays Americans. I didn't notice that over enunciation. He's trying hard to sound super American, like in some of his movies. I thought he seemed pretty comfortable with the character and the dialect. And I think that's a bit of an understated performance. But again, he's giving the screen over to Plummer, who was the flashier role. And in some ways, Melanie Laurent has a pretty colorful character too that he's interacting with. I just really like her. Back to Inglourious Basterds, she's actually quite an accomplished filmmaker. I saw a few years ago when TIFF had digital screenings, she had I'm not sure what happened to that film as far as wide release or whatever, but she had quite an epic film that she directed. She was also acting in it, and it was terrific. So, I just wish more people would cast her because I think she was really good. She was my second favorite performance in Inglourious Basterds. Obviously, Christoph Waltz, kind of steals that entire movie. But I was like, who is this French woman? Because she had the perfect look for Tarantino's movie, and then seeing her in this role, which is quite different from that one and some other stuff. I think she's a bit underrated as well. So it's a restrained film. And I think, you know, I mean, I don't know Mike Mills or how much, if this was based on his father or what
it was actually. I do recall coming across that it was like, that was the impetus for him to write this story and tell it was, this was similar to his story with his dad. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's autobiographical in every sense, but that was definitely the seed.
Yeah. I mean, the equivalent of his character, he he does, I think, designs album covers or something like that. And he's doing this whole thing about the sads, but it's because he's sad and like this family of these images, and it's not really working for the band. That these
just do portraits. They finally
do a portrait of it and be done with it. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. This isn't, it's more straightforward. I think this is one I could recommend to a wider group of people than some of the others, as great as the other movies are. I think it is really clever. And again, I don't know why it took me three viewings of this to figure out what he was doing. Every once in a while, there would be a color thing that would pop up.
Right.
And they're like, oh, why is he doing, like, I kind of get this is the year that this happened and that quick cutting and all that. Why is he doing all this with color? But then the rainbow flag, for crying out loud. I mean, and that becomes a little bit more evident, I guess, in the second act. And,
I did find myself wondering, was it just a matter of wanting to keep the same actors? But like, we only ever saw Mom when he was a kid in those memories and those flashbacks. And the only time we ever saw Dad interact with her, we only ever saw the back of him. So like, there was no attempt to try to put Dad and Mom, like there was no flashbacks or memories of them all together. We only ever saw him as a kid with Mom, and stuff from him and Dad in the past 5 years since his dad came out of the closet. And I was like, we didn't have anything of them all together. So,
yeah. And I wondered about that too. And I'm just going to, I'll give Mills credit in this. I think it's because like they were on the surface, a functional family, but they, there was something that was, off or dysfunctional. Just as a kid, he couldn't quite process that or figure it out. So that's why the memories seem separated, and that's why we don't really see them together. But yeah, but it could also have been, making an indie film.
Yeah, we don't want to have a young version of Christopher Plummer. We're not going to do CG.
Yeah. no CG, please, in beginners. Yeah. Yeah, anyway, is there anything else you'd like to say about beginners? Or?
No.
I'd recommend it to a lot of people. I think it's one of those movies where somebody won an Oscar, but not a lot of people think about it anymore. Kind of even went under the radar back then, other than Plummer's performance. I think it's really good.
You go public and 30 million people hear what you got to say. Nothing, I mean nothing, will ever be the same again.
Now, the work we did here is confidential, not for public scrutiny, any more than our one's family matters. We're very serious about protecting our interests.
He's got something to say. He wants to say it. I want it on 60 Minutes.
Maybe for the audience, it's just voyeurism, something to do on a Sunday night. And maybe it won't change a thing. And people like myself and my family are left hung out to dry, used up, alone.
What does this guy have to say?
Now, don't be paranoid, Jim.
That threatens these people.
That isn't cigarettes are bad for you.
Who is this?
They have no right to hide behind a corporate agreement. He can talk, we can air it.
The worst kind of an organized smear campaign against a whistleblower.
Shoplifting, failing to pay child support.
They can paint everything with that brush.
What are you going to do now? You're going to finesse me, lawyer me some
Mike.
More? Try Mr. Wallace.
If we aired this segment...
I was told...
Don't talk!
Mind my own business.
We could be a grave risk.
We're doing this with or without you, Lowell.
Are you a businessman or are you a newsman? He's only the key witness in the biggest public health reform issue in U.S. history. Does he go on television and tell the truth? Yes. Is it newsworthy? Yes. Are we gonna air it? Of course not. Why? Because he's not telling the truth. No, because he is telling the truth. And the more truth he tells, the worse it gets.
You manipulated me into this.
I fought for you and I still fight.
The American public need to know.
Jeffrey!
And you wish you hadn't come forward?
Dr. Wagon's deposition will be part of this record.
You wish you hadn't blown the whistle?
Jeffrey!
Do I think it's worth it?
I told the truth. It's valid and true and provable.
These people, that's not the point whether you tell the truth or not.
I still have these clear memories of being in university, John Mitchell Building, and 1999 was like such a great year. such a great year. And I'm often on this program, on my podcast, talking about 99 was such a packed year. And this poor, underrated film that didn't get enough attention that got lost in 1999. The Insider was not lost in 1999. It had the critical praise. It made Russell Crowe a star. Al Pacino was there. Christopher Plummer, just people all of a sudden remembered how good he is. And this is one of, and almost started a little bit of a trend of these films, which are set a few years after the events happened, but everybody, you know, most of them are still in their jobs, and you can still, you know, this time see Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes, right, and think about, oh, you know, some people would even remember the interviews and how that happened. It's about Jeffrey Wigand, and he becomes a whistleblower about big tobacco and how they found ways to make their cigarettes more addictive. A reluctant hero, because he wasn't actually, it was a complete accident that he ended up being this guy, as according to the film. He's coming over to just do a little bit of a technical piece of information there for Al Pacino, who is Lowell Bergman. Did I have that right? Lowell Bergman, yeah. Minutes producer at the time. And then Wigand gets very nervous and says, yeah, but I'm not going to break my confidentiality because otherwise I'll lose my severance. And like, okay, what, there's something more going on. Why is this guy so nervous to just talk about this? And then a whole series of other events happen, and this guy unveils what's happening. And the politics of it, I think it's such a big movie from Michael Mann, who does big films. And he's, the line on him, he loves making movies about people who are the best in their professions. And we see that in this as far as the news media. But there's a plenty of satire in here, and about the corruption of the news and journalism by having corporations control the networks that they're on. And the concern is, and the reason that in the center of the film, as brave as he is to give this interview, it gets cut down to almost nothing because CBS corporate gets nervous that it's going to interfere with a deal for Westinghouse to buy the network where they need the money, and that the connections of big tobacco. And I mean, it's just a criticism of the whole structure of things, which I think has gotten worse in, you know, times the story happened to the time where we live in now. A lot of big ideas. I think Crowe does give a great performance. I think it's the flashier of the performances. I was already kind of big on Russell Crowe before this because
LA Confidential.
The year before, LA Confidential, I think he should have been nominated for best actor for that. And it wasn't, I mean, it has some big scenes and some flashy scenes, but I found that to be a more subtle performance. It less of here's the costume and here's kind of the mannerisms and all of those pieces. But there's no doubt this was a great performance. You mentioned the Oscar trajectory of he's nominated for the first time for this role. There may have been some people out there. I don't know if I'm allowed to admit that I was an American Beauty guy that year, and I was.
So was I.
And I actually had, you know, would have voted for Spacey, and Spacey won. But a lot of people thought Crowe should have won for that. So let's give the makeup Oscar the next year for Gladiator. I think the thing that was interesting beyond that is the very next year, for a third year in a row, he was nominated for Best Lead Actor for A Beautiful Mind, which to me is the performance of the three that I think blows the other two away,
right,
to be honest. But Russell Crowe's a guy I like. I mean, I don't know if you saw The Pope's Exorcist.
I have not.
It is like he is having a ball, but he is the reason that that movie works. And he knows exactly how to play it big, but just big enough that it, you know, it makes this, you know, supposed true story horror movie work way better than it has any business working. I think even now he has it. I mean, he doesn't get as many roles, and some of the roles he's getting are just, you know, he was in the last Thor movie, and that was a bit controversial, that film. And I heard your review with Larry Parsons, a Rankin review.
Plug for Larry.
So I'm not sure it's quite what it was in the late 90s and early aughts. But this led to all of that, just kind of that four-year punch of those four roles were amazing. And he did some other side films kind of during those years as well. He suddenly became a very important actor, and a lot of people didn't initially know he was Australian because he could play an American, he could play somebody who was British, kind of like a Gary Oldman type of effect, where a bit of a chameleon for a while there. But
yeah.
I actually, the performances I preferred are Pacino, but if you know me, you know Pacino's kind of my guy. It's hard for me to criticize. I have seen some bad Pacino performances, and he lives up there. But I think this was actually a pretty restrained, down-to-earth performance from him. And just some great scenes here. But Plummer's scenes, wow, he is good at playing Mike Wallace. And he didn't get a supporting actor nomination in that really super crowded year of 1999, but it's especially that scene where he is ripping corporate apart.
Yeah.
He's so upset about how they've screwed up his piece and his interview, that so much power in there, yet he also nailed the role. Like this, you forget you're watching an actor play that role because he's so good in that this performance. I just think, I have some picky things here and there, but The Insider is just a classic movie. And again, I almost think, like, when people think of 99, they think of Fight Club and some movies like that. But The Insider is almost a best picture film that has been forgotten about, too, in all these years since. It's a really good movie that people should check out.
Yeah. A friend of mine just watched it for the first time not too long ago. And, not only do we text, he lives in Winnipeg, mm-hmm. But he's on social media quite often. So just because of the algorithm, and he's on there so often, usually when I hop on to like wish people happy birthday on Facebook, I'll see his posts because he's just active. And he's like, why have I never seen this movie is amazing. He finally watched it like a few months ago. I'm like, my response like, welcome to the club, man.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
thank you for joining us. Like, I remember sitting in the movie theater here in Saskatoon, watching it in 99 when it came out, and just feeling energized and inspired and wanted like that's the kind of stuff, like, in terms of most of the movie is people talking on phones, which sounds really boring, but it's tense, and it's because of Michael Mann's, his shot compositions, how he loves to push in on the camera, just getting right up over someone's ear, over their eye, and then the score, right? Like, you put the right music underneath anything, and you're like, oh, something's going on here. Something's happening. Something's not right.
There's an intense sequence with faxes.
Yes.
Faxes going back and forth. And that, I mean, now if I like talk to kids about what's a fax, I mean, they have no idea, but that is used so well in the film. Yeah. When I no doubt is accurate. Yeah. It feels accurate that there'd be these moments like that.
Why I think it works so well, I think it probably is the longest of all the ones we watch. It is, yes, Michael Mann doesn't mind running long. It really is like two arcs. It's the arc about his decision of Wygant to go public, and that's the first arc. And then you think, oh wow, okay, well now where is this going? And then it's all about, oh, CBS wants to squash it, and then you really get to watch Pacino as Lowell Bergman kind of then go, no, I can't accept this. And you get to watch him play all the cards he's got in his deck to make sure that I'm not going to leave this guy. I'm not going to hang him out to dry. I can't. It's my fucking reputation. Mm-hmm. And no one's going to know that he's done all this work, or a very small group of people will know, or they'll know he did it, but they won't know how he did it. But we get to watch him just move every piece to make it happen, while also getting ready to do the Unabomber story.
Yes, that's right.
At the end, and bookended too, when he's like, setting up interviews with Hezbollah. Like, you get the sense of like, oh my God, this guy's doing all of these things all at the same time.
I mean, that's something you never see if you just watch. You see the on-air personnel, but a segment producer and like where they have to go, and an executive producer, and how the network structure. I think that it's not the first movie to show those roles, but it does such a good job of highlighting that for a show that on Sunday night, in especially that time in America, was a number one show that people would watch to get the latest information and a more in-depth look at the issues of the day. But also the fact that there, something like this would almost destroy that show, and the infighting and all the stuff that had to happen, and like people lose their jobs because of this.
Mm-hmm.
Really good people because of the methods that had to happen. But, you know, the fact that this is not a producer, it's somebody who cares. He wants a great story out. He wants this information out to the American public and the world, but he's not willing to just like reach out to people and they're sacrificial lambs for this. And he doesn't care what happens to them after we get the story, particularly when it's handled as bad as it is. And I'm not sure. I mean, I think people this time generally knew, oh yeah, cigarettes are addictive and they can be bad for you. But that kind of level of corruption was happening. I think that was kind of new information that the film did a great job of highlighting. And yeah, I really like when Michael Mann's making a movie like this. It's not my favorite Michael Mann film. I probably would say Heat is my favorite, which a lot of people would. I love this movie he did when he was an up-and-comer called Thief, with James Caan's in. And I liked Collateral some years after this with Jamie Foxx and Tom Cruise. And
yeah.
I haven't seen Ferrari yet. I heard really good things about Ferrari, and I'm interested in taking a look at that one. It had Oscar buzz, but that didn't really turn into anything.
Translate, yeah. I saw Adam Driver doing some interviews about it, and that's kind of all I know, and him talking about, you know, Michael Mann's, you know, man, it's like to put him and David Fincher in a room and just...
Those two are intense fellows, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I remember there was that TV show that he did, Luck, which I saw, but it was, it was a couple big personalities that were clashing on that one. And so I think Michael Mann's making a Michael Mann film, and he's usually pretty good. The only one of his that I'm not a huge fan of, and maybe I need to revisit it and come at it, because I saw it in theaters and it was years ago, was Ali. I didn't care for that film as much as everybody else did. But
I remember liking it, but I've never gone back to it.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what that says.
I think I found some things a little bit overdone there, but that's, yeah. But I think that might have been, again, expecting something and then getting something different than I thought. And that's, now I appreciate that a little bit more, I guess. Yeah, and I do like to. I think if I was to point out a weakness, Diane Venora, who is a collaborator, was in Heat as well.
Yeah.
Plays Wygant's wife. It's not a great character. I mean, and she feels a little bit wooden sometimes. I mean, I've seen her almost get there in some roles. I like her enough in Heat, but I've heard this criticism that Michael Mann sometimes, as a writer, is not fantastic at writing women.
Yeah, I would agree with that sentiment at the end. What I've always loved about Diane Venora is she's not afraid to play unlikable characters or people who might make decisions that we go, well, oh God, like she's going to leave them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, but you know, you kind of understand why, but he's like, so, but you know, she's the one who's going to step up in a Michael Mann film and play the role that's probably going to be the least sympathetic one of it all. But yeah, to that point. And also like Lizzie Krause is in this one too, playing, Pacino's part, and it's like she was barely acting at that point. And I just remember, like, how the hell did Michael Mann convince her? Like, I remember at that point thinking, this is amazing. Caught her to come out and do another film.
I mean, he had so many people in Heat, in the movie Heat, like everybody came out for that. And I think, you know, that would ended up being something that they thought should have been celebrated a little bit more in 1995. And I think, okay, it's like, we need to pay attention to this guy again and get into his next project. And I think he maybe had his pick of actors, and also like just having a strong screenplay and strong material goes a long way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it would be silly for me to criticize that this was one of the best movies of 1999. I think at that time, I'd say I'd be guilty of being somebody who was such a competitive Oscar person. That I became threatened any movies that could beat the movies that were my favorites of the year. That when it came out, I was like, okay, well, now this is a couple months after American Beauty. And my favorite movie that year was Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, which of course was a little bit too polarizing to have any impact. But I was thinking, okay, people aren't going to remember those two movies because this has come out and everything is about The Insider. This is probably now going to win Best Picture. And I don't know if it's the best movie, but maybe I went in arms crossed a little bit and expecting quite a bit of the Russell Crowe performance, now, when like relax and history is history, you watch this and it's just a great story.
Yeah.
Well acted. All the pieces are there. The cinematography is
so
exceptional.
Good.
There's that one scene when everything is falling apart for Wigan, and he's sitting in his chair, and then we kind of see him disappear. Like, what a cool, like, I mean, they don't make a meal out of it, but it's just such a cool shot. And
it would have been a more difficult effect to make in 99 or 98, yeah, depending on when they were putting all, it came out later in 99, as I recall.
Yeah, it was the fall. So it would
have been, they would have been editing it earlier that year, but you know, nowadays you could just pull that shot off with CG and cameras or whatever and have someone working on it like months ahead of time. It's like, I still imagine, don't
think it would be as magical.
Other things that put, like Colin Feore, Canadian Colin Feore is in it, yeah, playing a Mississippi lawyer.
Maybe that's not fair. Sometimes I have trouble with him as an actor.
Mm-hmm, yeah, fair enough.
You know, he can also come off a little bit stiff, or I can see him acting as opposed to playing the character. This is one of his best performances, I think.
Yeah. And to your point, what you said earlier too, like, I've often used, like, you know, after Scarface, it's of course, this is speaking in big general terms, but I felt like that was the birth of Pacino being an over the top actor, that he kind of went on, and, you know, because then Scent of a Woman was, you know, a few years, more than a few, but, you know, a bit earlier in the 90s than this, and he was still playing big characters. And whenever anyone goes, but yeah, that's all he did was just big characters, I'm like, go watch The Insider.
I might also say, watch Donnie Brasco too, which was around the same, 98 was Donnie Brasco the year before. Right, yeah. And he's the opposite of the flashy gangster in that. I mean, he still was one of his true life gangster films, but he is not like that in that movie either. Yeah, I remember even before Scarface, like in Justice for All, he has that, you're out of order. This whole courtroom's out of order. He was given those big moments even in the 70s. But yeah, I think it became bigger and bigger. And yeah. I don't know why I let him get away with that. And others, like, I would criticize. I don't know. Maybe it's just, yeah, you just have to take, you know, my criticisms with Pacino. It's hard for me to be as critical of him as some others. He was one of those inspirations for getting interested in film and trying for a bit as far as the acting thing goes too, but it was a mistake because I went into the drama department trying to be Al Pacino, and that was not that was not the type of actor Jason DeBray would have been then or now or ever.
the last thing I'll throw in about The Insider, and I guess maybe it's more about Michael Mann and the movies he was making at this point, but I loved how in Heat in 95, and then this one, 99, like, he was using contemporary music. Like, he, you know, Moby was I can still remember, you know, the credit song in terms of God Moving Over the Water. Maybe I'm making a bad job of the track title going off the top of my memory. But then, you know, and then The Insider, he's using Massive Attack. He's using contemporary music artists or more of that kind of synthesized digital creation process as backdrops, and I don't think there was a lot of people doing it at that point. Like, it was a really different way of juxtaposing a contemporary story of what was going on, but with a different kind of musical score, and I really, really liked that at that time.
Yeah, his music choices, I think they've always been good. Like, you go even looking at Thief, and the music score for Heat, I always think of that. I mean, you just mentioned, I can hear that music right now. I'm in those moments, especially like the climax of that film. And it's not a surprise that he knows what he's doing. What's a surprise to me is that the last few years have been a little bit rocky for him. Right. I don't know what the roadblock has been, because he would make some movies, then there'd be these years in between, then he was hot again. And then he goes through this other lull. I'm hoping Ferrari maybe leads to more projects, but it could be also he's being really choosy, or he's taking his time between projects, which is fine. We know lots of filmmakers who do that. But yeah, when there's a new Michael Mann film, I'm excited to see it, even if it's not as good as the stuff he was doing in the 90s, which I think were kind of like his peak time as a filmmaker. That 1-2 punch of Heat and The Insider, I don't think you can
No one's going to make two better films back to back.
You are the only person who could still recognize the man who murdered our families. Do you remember what you said you would do when Ruth died? I have planned everything for you. You must follow these steps precisely. His name is Otto Wallisch. You must find him. You must kill him.
I'm looking for my father.
Sir, you're gonna have to check your bag.
I've already called the police.
Passport?
We are the last living survivors.
Stand by the window.
Who are you?
Please, don't yell.
Who's a Nazi?
Nazi. Beatrice. Did your father ever talk to you about Germany?
Are you kidding me? No, he's a collector, right? What's that?
I'm sorry, I...
What's going on here?
I will go...
Sit down! You gotta answer some questions right now!
Do you want to continue?
I must finish. I must.
Remember's an interesting film. I didn't see it in theaters. It came out after he won his Oscar for Beginners, and I think it was maybe up for some awards in Canada. But
it was. I think he won the Canadian Screen Award. Yeah.
He did, yeah. And so it was kind of like going back in the Canadian production, even though most of it, there's a little section in Canada, but most of it's set in the U.S. We start off in a nursing home where he's a Jewish man who has recently lost his wife, but he has dementia. So he regularly forgets that he's lost his wife. And the great Martin Landau is in the nursing home and reminds him that he made a promise to his wife that involves going and trying to find the SS officer from Auschwitz who killed most of his family. Martin Landau's written all these letters to remind him that his wife has passed and this is his mission and this is what he needs to do. It's obviously well-financed as we kind of go on this journey where he escapes the home. He goes into a series of taxis and buses and he gets picked up in different cars. And there's a plan for all this, seeking out all these people with the same name. And we get several scenes where we think he's found that person, but then we find out some more information. And then Henry Cherney, a great Canadian actor, plays his son who's trying to find him. And my father with dementia is lost, and he's incredibly worried about him. And then we have some actors I really enjoy show up here. Dean Norris plays, I think it looks like he's a police officer, a security officer.
Yeah, I think he's a state trooper. I think he's on the vehicle, as I recall.
Yeah. And we think it's his father is this SS officer, but that leads to kind of an interesting sequence, which I may have some criticisms of, but I really like that use of Dean Norris in the movie. And then we do build up to eventually getting to this house where we see Bruno Ganz, who's, I think, quite a good actor. I mean, I've appreciated him in a variety of... He kind of disappears into roles, too, which I've... And he used to work with Wim Wenders in some of his movies in the 70s and 80s. And I almost didn't recognize him as well for a really big reveal towards the end. I won't spoil it because I'm not sure a lot of people have seen this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'll tell you my honest opinion the first time I saw it.
Okay.
I hated it. I started off really liking it. I was completely on board, and Plummer's great and everything. And then we get to some big moments, and I've now isolated it down to two big moments on the rewatch that I think undermine and perhaps ruin the other work, which seems actually quite good. But, you know, and knowing Adam McGoin, I've seen some of his movies where I really love what he does. I've seen some of his movies where I've just, what were you doing? Like, where it really doesn't work for me at all. So, and I had actually forgotten, and when the first time I saw it, that McGoin was the director. At the end, I was like, oh, okay, that makes some sense after what I've just seen. I feel still like I lightened up when I watched it this week to prepare for this conversation. I relaxed with it. I enjoyed and focused on more of the good. But I think the screenplay kind of lets this great cast down, particularly Plummer. I think maybe part of my thing is, and perhaps I shouldn't get like this, but I think one of the things I was resenting a little bit when I first saw it is the fact that dementia was being used as this plot device for this kind of revenge story. I mean, it's obviously, it's called Remember. It's very important to the whole thing. And then I'm also criticizing, like, okay, was it that easy to escape from the old folks' home? Right. Hospital later on. What's the security like in this hospital?
I know that was the one that made me go, like, he was in a hospital. How did he walk out the door?
Am I missing a scene here? Like, what's happening? Like, it seems very easy. And then there's all these false starts where we think he's going to get caught, a conversation with this little kid that kind of goes sideways, this other scene with this girl where she reads this letter and finds out what he's doing. I was wondering, is there a girl that age who wouldn't know what a Nazi is? Because that seems like the girl's reading it. And what's a Nazi? And I just didn't buy that. I kept fighting with the movie, I guess. I fought with it less the second time. I see its benefits. I just feel like if this had been maybe even a campier, straight up, you know, kind of Nazi revenge film, you know, and it played it big, then I would have been like not questioning it as much. But because I think they were really trying to say something about dementia and old age, but also trauma and trauma from the concentration camps and the Holocaust, I don't know if it all works. I'm still kind of wrestling with it. My thumb is not way down now. It's kind of mildly down. I feel like I want to like this movie, but the payoff to the Dean Norris sequence is so over the top, and it just becomes so ridiculous. It starts off kind of in a natural way, but you're kind of thinking he's in a dangerous situation, which he is, but then it just turns into something that was really like a kind of a cheap action movie payoff. And it almost felt that way too in the climax for me of the film, when and we get our reveals about everything that's been going on. And I don't know, I did just, for some reason, it almost offended me or made me angry the first time. I'm chilling out on it a little bit, but it's not my favorite of the movies we're talking about, but it is the one that probably gives Christopher Plummer the most to do, because he beginning to end, we are with him from the first scene to the last scene, and almost the last scene. And, you know, I think he does an amazing job. He plays the notes of dementia really well, like when he, you know, starts to lose where he is and all that. And also just the when he's waking up and he still thinks his wife is alive, and the panic around that, and his heart breaks every time he gets that news. That's played really well. And I also, there's a scene where he's in a hotel, and the server and this kid bumps the server, and this coffee is spilled on his letter, and the panic that he has, that could have been played too big, but it felt exactly right for an older person to lose, you know, potentially lose this really important thing, which is kind of key to his survival. Yeah. So I'm almost trying to talk. I do this sometimes. I talk too much when I'm trying to. I should be giving my thumbs up, but that's where I'm at with Remember. I don't know how you feel about it.
I don't disagree with anything you say. I think I'm still, maybe it sounds like I'm still higher on it totality, but it's because of how good he is in it. And I think why I think he's so great is, at least especially within the conversation of these six movies, this is the only time he's like low status. Like he's either playing a historical figure or a fictional character of great status and power in all of the other ones. But this is one where, as you pointed out, right, he ends up not knowing every day, essentially, okay, what's happening? What am I doing? And it's a bit like Memento, right? In that he's got to go back to the letter and kind of
So it reminded me of Memento. It didn't feel like a ripoff or anything like that. But not I was like, okay, but
they're totally different films. Yeah. I mean, like if the tattoos that he uses to try to remember things, yet,
yeah,
you know, there's a similar type of an arc there.
Yeah. It was nice to see that because, you know, it was like a Canadian, I think might have been Germany, the other country that co-produced
but
because of the Canon involvement, I was like, oh, there's my friend Liza. She played his daughter-in-law. Like, so it's like, she's in the scenes. Yeah. I was like, nice. Oh, there's Liza.
I thought you might know some people involved.
Yeah. And it's like Jane, that's Jane Spence at the end playing in the big final scene. She's the daughter of the house owner, right, that he finds. But yeah, I don't disagree with you at all in terms of like, yeah, that's a bit of a reach, and that's a bit of a reach in terms of just plot points. But boy, he was good in it. And you kind of pointed this out, even maybe if you're not saying it specifically, the points that I had trouble with came later in the film. And by that point, I was already really invested, so I was willing to go with it.
I guess what I'd say is because I felt that he was giving such a great performance and the actors were, and the first half was, I mean, it's a pretty extraordinary premise and situation here, but I'm going along with it. I'm entertained by it. That when these moments happened, they were just an enormous disappointment for me. It's almost like if I start off in the movie is just bad, and you can tell from scene one onward that this is a bad movie, then you might not enjoy it, but you're preparing yourself for the whole thing for it to be bad. When it starts off so strong and then it dips in that way, I think that's maybe why I felt so emotionally upset with the film.
Right.
Right or wrong. Is it a better made movie than Adam Sandler's latest comedy? Yes.
Right. Yeah.
I bashed Sandler a lot on the show, but I think I'm just more upset by this. But do you think it's wrong to feel upset about? I mean, it's no feelings are wrong, but do you think I'm being too hard on it in that way or?
Well, no, you think what you think. Like there's nothing, you know, for me too, I didn't have many of the thoughts until after I was like over in the kitchen doing dishes, thinking about the film. And then the more I thought about it after the fact, it would bug me. It didn't bother me as much as I was watching it. Okay. But no, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I guess it didn't bring it down for me as much as it did for you. But it was like, here's four names. Yeah, and it's like, well, I'm gonna guess right now it's gonna take to the fourth name to find what he's looking for. Like, you know what I mean? Like, kind of saw that coming at least. So there's things like that. Like, yes, I guess that gives your film a structure and whatnot. But and I just realized too, I said Jane Spence. It should have been Jane Spidell. I'm not sure if my friends Jane Spence or Jane Spidell will hear this, but I'm like, wait a minute. I just realized I said my friend Jane Spence's name. And no, it's Jane Spidell who plays that part.
That's one of those things that afterwards, like, you know, I go to editing, sometimes I'll have said something and I'm like, can I fix that now? Yeah.
Fix it in ADR. It was cool seeing Martin Landau in that too, because he passed away not long after this movie.
I think he died before Plummer. I mean, he does look fairly old in this in this film. I've been a fan of his. I mean, obviously Ed Wood and Tucker, and I liked him in The Majestic, a movie that not a lot of people remember with Jim Carrey too. Mm-hmm. And this was a good late career role for him as well. And yeah, I just appreciate they were able to get him involved with this film too. So I mean, they had, I think, all the right people there. Agoyen, I think, still kind of carries a little bit of weight from his Oscar nominations for The Sweet Hereafter in the 90s.
Which Plummer was in. So like it makes sense that they would work together again.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I sometimes think after that, and maybe it was before it, I don't know, but Agoyen became a little bit maybe too in love with his artistry, and he was making bold choices, but he wasn't making kind of bold like David Cronenberg choices. Like, and I know Cronenberg would have his semi-realistic films and he would have his horror ones, but he would play things big. But Agoyen's films kind of start off like these are meant to be like down-to-earth stories, even if they're extraordinary circumstances. But then things go really wild and towards the end. And sometimes I'm kind of like, okay, am I supposed to think that this is genius because this was unexpected? Or is this just showy and not as worthy of or in comparison to some of his great works? I think this is more subtle than say, Where the Truth Lies. I don't know if you saw that movie. That was another one that, for whatever reason, that movie made me so mad by the end. I thought it was one of the worst movies that year. And I kind of thought, again, you have a super talented cast and all these people in here, and then that this is our payoff at the end. I think people should check it out. I don't regret seeing it, and I've now watched it twice. I'm glad I watched it a second time, because I thought I could be coming in if I'm like, I don't really want to watch this again because I had such a miserable time the first time. But I might be coming in with just a bit of just the emotional response as opposed to a slightly more objective look at the film. And so it didn't quite get over like the 3-star line for me, if you know what I mean. But I saw more of the good. Like, the good scenes are really good.
Yeah.
And so I just think the screenplay is a bit convoluted. We have some illogical things that happen in there. I can maybe put up with that. But yeah, I just feel like some of those action payoffs and some of those big violent moments there, I suppose it may be earned, but it just didn't feel quite as authentic as the rest of the film did.
My dear boy, if you were to become Tolstoy's private secretary, you would be given a great gift.
You're the new secretary?
Yes.
Papa is upstairs in the library.
I'm so glad you're here.
Pardon me. I sneeze, I get nervous.
The world's greatest living writer.
You all think he's Christ, don't you?
I do believe he's one of the prophets.
This is unbearable. I'm surrounded by morons.
Is planning his legacy.
Your works are the birthright of the Russian people.
I cannot stand by while they steal my children's inheritance.
I need to know anything the Countess says. She's very, very dangerous.
Valentin Fedorovich, you've been keeping something from me.
I believe that there's one truth, love.
It's not something they'd understand, these so-called disciples of my husband's. I love a romance.
You must see by now how committed she is to undermining her husband's best intentions.
Why do you betray me like this? You'd rather be seduced by charlatans, all in the name of love. You can't even love me.
If I can't work and find some peace, then I shall go away.
Let's go!
They have a whole life together. Why do you have to deny that?
You've become a victim of her romantic nonsense.
I don't know who I am anymore.
He wants to see her. Let her go.
What are you afraid of?
You. I'm afraid of you.
I've never stopped loving you, but God knows you don't make it easy.
Why should it be easy? I am the work of your life, you are the work of mine. That's what love is.
Everything that we have worked for will be gone.
You want to create an icon. It's going to look more like you than him.
Michael Hoffman's The Last Station is based on a novel about Tolstoy and his wife, and kind of in the last years of his life when he had become quite a prominent figure, to the point where there's almost a cult-like status that he has. And the film really is, it's about kind of the central love story. There's a second love story happening as well among some younger characters, but about how, you know, there's disagreements between Helen Mirren, who feels that her rather large family should profit off of his success with the writing that he has done. But Paul Giamatti's in there and convincing him that, you know, he needs to give back, and his work needs to belong to everybody in Russia, and it needs to be for the public, and just give away the rights to all that. And there's a bit of a battle going on in there. In the meantime, James McAvoy is, as a devout follower, goes to work with him. He's promise, he's following these strict ideals, like live pure, no sex, all of this stuff, which, you know, as Plummer, as Tolstoy says, you know, this is not actually how I've lived my life at all.
Yeah.
And you need to sort of like loosen up a little bit here. And Carrie Condon, who he meets, they kind of almost like she has sex with him just to try to get him to loosen up a little bit, but then there's this attraction there. Kerry Condon, I've talked about this on the, especially a year ago with the Oscar show. That was one of my favorite performances last year in Banshees of Inisherin. I thought she should have won the Oscar again. Once again, no disrespect to Jamie Lee Curtis, but I just thought that was just one of the great performances of the year. I forgot she was in this. This was my second viewing of it. And I don't know how she manages. She's not being flashy or anything, but she seems to steal every scene she's in. So that's kind of like the second tier or low-key MVP for me in this mm-hmm. film. But Plummer and Mirren are terrific. But what this is kind of almost, this is a little bit of an interesting thing. Like all these movies, I'm having different experiences on the second or third watch. The first time I saw it, I liked it enough, like a 3-star passable thumbs up. This time I found some of the scenes just so big and actory, and at points very melodramatic. And I don't know if that, I just ignored that, or I just didn't pay attention because I was just getting my head around the story the first time I saw it. This time I just really saw problems. It looks good. It looks like it should be full marks film, but the performances are good. But I think this was well within both of their wheelhouses, and it's fun to watch those two play off each other. But it's really big. Actually, it's particularly Helen Mirren, who's, you know, one of our great actors. But I think, you know, and maybe it's just, again, historical ignorance about what she was like as a person, but she's like tripping into scenes, and she has these big emotional beats that she plays. She plays them well, but it just feels like a lot. Plummer, as this bigger than life personality, almost comes down to looking rather subtle compared to Mirren's performance.
Mm-hmm.
I like them. I understand why they were both nominated for Oscars for this. It was a weird thing for me. This sometimes happens with the award categories too. He was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. I think he has equal screen time to Helen Mirren. She was up for lead actress, but he was up for supporting actor. I don't think that.
And I'll just throw this in now. It's James McAvoy's movie.
He's the central character.
Yeah.
His eyes. He's, I guess, arguably he's the lead and Plummer's the supporting in that way, but it was made up to sort of be Helen Mirren's movie, I guess, but...
Yeah.
And I shouldn't let a horse.
And he had the infamous with credit with James McAvoy. So I don't know if that's
right.
We'll do that. He'll get a special place on the back end and let Helen and Chris take the front too.
Yeah, I think Paul Giamatti gets third billing. And I mean, yeah, he's at that point he was a bigger name, and still really is. I guess I really like him. I've always liked him. I don't think he has much of a character here. It's just kind of almost a two-dimensional villain.
He literally is twiddling the mustache.
The wax isn't in, and they're talking about what's wrong with your mustache. He hasn't put the wax up or whatever. But he's very puritanical, and I mean, the nature of the story, it looks like he's trying to steal these works, and at points, like, trying hard to prevent when Tolstoy is... towards the end, he's on his deathbed trying to keep his wife away from him. Again, I know it's because she's so big and dramatic, and that's going to upset him more is kind of the thought behind it. But it's still seems we're not meant to like him from the beginning, and we don't like him. I guess he does his job in that way. I just don't think the screenplay did him any favors either. The costumes look great. The set decoration, art decoration. I like them. The McAvoy, Kerry Condon, and there's the other daughter as well. I think that's a good performance as well. But this feels like another one where it looks good, it's well made enough, the performances are there, but my thumb is down. It's not way down, it's just sort of down. That's where I am with The Last Station.
Yep. No, it landed low for me, and that's not to say I think it's a bad movie overall. Like, you know, it's like, oh my god, no one should see it. But in terms of with the company that it keeps, mm-hmm. yeah, it's not high for me for all the reasons that you said. One thing I did like that I really liked was that spoiler alert, Tolstoy dies when they reach the train station, the last station, and they finally, you know, the daughter goes to get the countess and ultimately brings her in, and she's dramatic, over the top to begin with, and they had those lines where, like, you need to, like, I'm paraphrasing it, but you have to pull yourself together. Mm-hmm. And she just goes, you're right, I do. And there's a complete shift, and then she is actually quite, it's not stoic, that's still full of emotion, she's still there, you can tell she's still immensely sad and affected by the fact that he's dying. But then it's the daughter who has the bigger breakdown, and then she has to console her. I'm like, okay, that was a really cool payoff.
Yes.
I don't know if it undoes all the big over-the-top histrionics of the Countess up to that point, and how much is that, you know, I find myself wondering, I wonder how many different ways they took some of those scenes. Like, how big did she go in some takes, and how scaled back did she go? And then, you know, by the time you edit it together, like, how does it come out? But I really,
it's up to the editor and director, you know, and sometimes the director doesn't have a say. I think in this case, the director had a say as to which take they were going to use. I don't know. Mirren maybe was giving us a very subtle performance in some takes, but they liked the bigger ones. But
Who knows? But I really like the way, I like where they left her at the end of the movie. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
I had a similar thing where I'm like, I found myself having to work harder to stay focused on this one. I found myself wanting to drift. I'm like, okay, we can get through this part now. Yeah. I kind of felt like I knew why this scene was here, what it was trying to achieve. Can we move on?
It's not that long, but it does drag in places for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I had another thought with these big notes and these big performances. This may be a fantastic play. This might work better on the stage than it does as a film, if you're going to take that direction with the characters. But I think, you know, this was kind of the first in the last series of Oscar nominations that he got. As you said, Beginners was, I think, maybe the year after.
Yeah, it was right after.
Right after this. And so it was like, okay, we're finally recognizing this guy. I'm kind of glad he didn't win for this role, because I don't think it's his best, but he's good. I mean, and there's no doubt. And Helen Mirren is good, even though some things are just almost chewing the scenery. I'm just not used to that with her. Like, I've seen her, even if she has to play something big, it doesn't feel like she's acting. So, and that, again, that might be a little bit more on how she was directed.
Right.
On Mirren herself. So, I mean, I'm giving you for the benefit of the doubt when we have this whole other series of roles and performances from her, which are pitch perfect.
Yeah. And I also found myself like not really buying the, you know, in terms of the two relationship, A plot, B plot. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they feel like one's the A and the B, and then they feel like they switch.
Yeah.
But the younger romantic plot, I didn't buy it. I just felt like they didn't, there was stuff missing for me to like that. So when she finally comes to the station at the end,
and
I'm like, I didn't really buy it.
And she just happens.
It didn't feel earned, I guess, maybe is the better way to put it.
I would say like there's something missing there, because she's gone off to Moscow and left him, and she has this duty, you know, and it's been, I mean, it feels like a fling, I guess, more than anything else. But for him, it's his first love, this big, deep, whatever thing. But he's going on with the work he has to do. But yeah, she just happens to be there at the last station when this happens, to run up to him and have this emotional moment. I don't think it's Carrie Condon's fault, though. I just like how she just takes the reins in that relationship. And I don't think James McAvoy, again, he's an interesting guy, too. I mean, he... Mm-hmm. You know, he gets a lot of work. He's been in a ton of stuff. He's in obviously X-Men as well. And I remember I quite liked him in Atonement many, many years ago. And I think he does really well in period pieces, but he can also in Split, for example, M. Night Shyamalan film. He does a great job in a big role there of kind of balancing that act, which is not easy to do. He seems a little bit under the radar, but he just kind of gets swallowed up by the actors. He works with great actors, and he probably has a good agent and or somebody getting him these scripts and these roles here, but he just doesn't, he feels kind of bland compared to everybody else. Yet he is the central character, and he's the one we're following around the most in the film. So anything else about The Last Station? Say,
nope.
Yeah. This is another one of those ones that had two acting Oscar nominations. And I think has rightly or wrongly has been kind of forgotten about. This isn't one I'm like, yay, champion, but I just want people to know, this is a movie out here that exists. Maybe you haven't seen this Christopher Plummer performance or this Helen Mirren performance. Check it out, see what you think.
Imagine 30% of America unable to heat their houses. Or gasoline $20 a gallon at the pump.
It's running out. And 90% of what's left is in the Middle East. This is a fight to the death.
I think we've got something that utilizes your specific skill set.
His money's in a lot of dark corners.
I want you to take him from his hotel, drug him, put him in the front of a car, and run a truck into him at 50 miles an hour.
It's good to have you back in town, Bob.
You want to know what the business world thinks of you? We think 100 years ago you were living out here in tents in the desert chopping each other's heads off, and that's exactly where you're going to be in another 100. So, yes, on behalf of my firm, I accept your money.
It is illegal to offer gifts, money, or anything of value to influence foreign officials.
This is all business we're talking about, right?
You've just visited what could be the most profitable corporation in America.
Provided the government approves the merger.
Provided there's still chaos in the Middle East.
Do you understand what that means? It's like somebody put a giant ATM on our front lawn.
Corruption? Corruption is our protection. Corruption keeps us safe and warm. Corruption is why we win.
You're gonna give me names.
It's coming now. Take the target out.
Why am I being investigated? Why am I being investigated? Drop it.
Hey! 4 miles.
Your entire career, you've been used.
2 miles.
No, 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 no!
Where'd that job come from?
Goodbye, Bob. 1 mile.
Speaking of 19, or it was actually the year after that, so we talked about 1999, but then in 2000, a really important movie to me was Steven Soderbergh's version of Traffic. It had been based on a miniseries, yeah. And he did a fantastic job of telling multiple stories about the war on drugs and the flaws with it and everything, and sitting in three different areas. And that adaptation and leading to an Oscar was written by this guy, Stephen Gagan. And a few years later, he went into the director's chair and wrote and directed Syriana. And I was really excited about this movie. Talk about an all-star cast. Everybody who was big was in there. In particular, lots of buzz about George Clooney's performance, playing the CIA agent, and Matt Damon's in there. And it seemed like a lot of the people who'd worked with Steven Soderbergh were showing up in here. It was like a kind of a Soderbergh in the background type of,
because he was doing Ocean's 11 movies by that point as well. So
and they had Clooney, of course, out of sight, had worked with him a lot, you know, and a ton of other really amazing actors, probably too many to talk about. It's essentially about the world of oil, which was incredibly important at the time this movie came out because of the Iraq War and the Bush years and the controversial time that was then, and still I think oil is a big issue now. And this film, I think, ambitiously tries to tell multiple stories about what happens in that world and the corruption of it and the connection to the Middle East and Middle East oil and the U.S.'s role in kind of making sure, with ties to big oil companies, making sure they have the leaders they want in the Middle East. It's as concise a way as I can put it, as shown through these different stories. But George Clooney becomes very concerned. He's an aging CIA agent, that there's this bomb that has completely disappeared, and he can't get anybody in Washington or his superiors to listen. They're saying, like, he's sending out too many memos. He's causing too much heat. We need to put him on a desk job. And then he gets connected to this job because they're like, he's not a guy who belongs kind of behind a desk, to try to check out this, who they're saying is an enemy of the U.S. In the meantime, Matt Damon, who is an analyst for the markets.
Well, he works for a company, but then part of his job at the company is, he does, because you're right. Well, often when we get scenes of him, he's talking with him analyst TV stuff, but he actually works for an economic company.
Yes. And then he gets connected to this prince who could be the next in line, is the next in line after his father dies. And Matt Damon is convincing him that here's what you need to do to have a thriving country and economy so that you're not living as you were 300 years ago. And this guy starts to listen and he becomes kind of part of this team. But Matt Damon, I think, becomes excited about the future and maybe solving some problems in the Middle East if this guy can control things. But there's a younger brother, and the younger brother is a more manipulative guy. And Christopher Plummer, as
a firm of lawyers,
this big oil company that Chris Cooper is involved with. And he encounters this kind of the second in line and convinces him that he could run the country, but then he'd essentially be a puppet for American interests, and in particular, the interests of this oil company. If this is not sounding exciting, it's probably because of my description of it, because it's a super intelligent movie. It reminded me of when I saw the movie The Big Short as well, which was so technical in its knowledge. But you have these great actors in here, and you're appreciating from scene to scene what's going on and these stories that overlap. I would say this is another one, when I first saw it, I was like, okay, that wasn't what I was expecting. I was expecting some sort of an oil version of Traffic, which it kind of is, but I got lost in the story. And even now, I've watched it now three times, and as I describe it to you, I'm getting a bit lost in the story. and all these wonderful actors who make these appearances and then kind of disappear for a while. I mentioned Amanda Peet plays Matt Damon's.
Yeah, Jeffrey Wright is awesome in it.
Jeffrey Wright and
William Hurt's got a great small role.
He's got his father, his story about his father is an alcoholic and like he doesn't drink, but he's a good guy who kind of gets mixed in and ends up with a lot of power. And probably my two favorite scenes, if I pared it down, there's a great sequence with William Hurt, the late great William Hurt, and George Clooney. And William Hurt's now doing a private contractor, used to be with the CIA. And they're meeting in movie theaters and having drinks and different things. Those scenes are so, so good. Having those two together was amazing, because Clooney is a little bit of a William Hurt of his time, you know, and in some ways, you know, not completely, yeah. I guess. But the other scene that's really effective is when Clooney is in the diner with Christopher Plummer. Yeah. And
it's like a mini Heat scene.
It's good. It's as advertised, but Plummer has so much power, but then that power is taken away in that conversation by Clooney, and he says exactly what he's going to do to this guy, you know. And so it's all these individual vignettes, which I enjoy watching, but I don't know if it adds up to a whole. Now, first time I saw it, I kind of liked it. Second time I saw it, I got a little bit more and I liked it a little bit more. Watching it this time this week, I thought, wow, this has gone way up for me. I mean, it's actually, I think it would have been a little bit more in the middle if I had, you know, was doing points on this before. But now it's going to be higher than some films that I, on first watch, I actually appreciated more, because it's one that requires multiple watches. And even then, I think I need to revisit this one every few years to get my head around it. And also just to mark that particular still kind of confusing time in history. And I think maybe intentionally it's confusing because we don't always know as a general public what's going on with these oil prices, and somebody, it always seems like somebody's profiting off of this, but
right,
it's supposed to be based on a very objective business model, but is it or is it not, or is this just an element of not just American corruption but world corruption? I think the argument in this film is it's a lot of American corruption, and their system is broken and then breaks other parts of the world down. I think it's for those who know what they're getting into, I think it's a worthwhile film to check out. I don't know. It's not my favorite Clooney performance. It's another one where I don't know if he should have won for this one.
Right.
Because it's another example. The Descendants, which is one of my favorite, maybe my favorite of his performances, came out a couple of years later. And he didn't win Best Actor because he had recently won for this. And
right. That's the flip side of how it works. Yeah. The other way, sometimes if you get one award, it's like, oh, shoot, well, we can't give him another one right away. Was he Tom Hanks or something? We can't do that.
And I feel like that torture scene, which was very prominent in the advertising, that's a lot of why he won his award for this too. And finally, people are kind of taking him seriously as an actor. He'd been a TV star and moved into film acting and became a major player around this time. And they thought, well, now is the time to reward him. But I think he's been better in other things. He's good at this. He's one of many good people in the film.
Yeah. So. I remember when he won the Academy, I remember watching the Oscars. Like, I don't watch it regularly anymore. Yeah. I used to watch like every single year religiously. I remember when he won, because he was also nominated that year for Best Director for Good Night and Good Luck.
Yeah.
And then when he got up to get this Oscar, he's like, well, I guess I'm not getting best director. Like, he knew, his, like, there's no way they're going to give me two on one night. So
not going to do that.
Yeah, I was just checking the double, because I did, like, watching it again at the time. I had no idea, but, like, that's Mark Strong is the guy who's torturing him.
That's right. That's right.
And I'm like, he would never be cast in that role.
No.
Nowadays, like, we can't ask that actor to play a Middle Eastern, like, mm-hmm. you know, like, because that's the way he's made up and stuff like that, right? I like Tim Blake Nelson a lot when he pops up in movies, and he's in this one. The one that, like, seen specifically when you're kind of doing, like, the plot synopsis kind of breakdown, it's Alexander Siddig who plays the older prince, the older brother. And one of my favorite moments in the scene, you know, his Matt Damon's character, their oldest son dies tragically in a pool with his electrocution. That's one of the shots I was talking about before. I could vividly remember the camera pushing in on the cracked light in the pool flickering. It burned in my brain. So I'm like, here comes the shot. And, like, but after that, he's kind of fallen into this position where he feels like, all right, I'm being called upon because they feel bad that my son died at the fucking party. He's really why I'm here. Mm-hmm. And as he lays out, as you talked about in the plot synopsis, all of these things, like, this is what you need to do and blah, blah, blah. And his answer is, you don't think I fucking don't know this? Like, his response is like, yes, I agree. This is how educated I am. I went to this school. I went to this school. I know this already. That's not the problem. The problem is the fucking, the president calls my dad. And next thing you know, we're giving you all our resources. It was a really great flip. Yes. In it, where it's like, yeah, it's not about the Americans coming to save the day. And, like, we've got these ideas. It's like, we already know what the problem is.
And as the events of the film move forward, that's where the Americans want it. And that's why they want the other son.
Exactly. You can't have the idealist, the one who actually is trying to make change. Yeah. We actually, if everything, for those of us in these positions of control and power, money and oil, if we want it to keep that way, then we have to make sure that this guy who actually has good ideas and knows what the problem is, we need him to go away.
And that's an exciting sequence. I mean, it's in the advertising for it. That, if I'm identifying, I would call that the climax of the film, when there's danger for many, many characters, and some manage to survive, but some others, they are, like, willing to kill off some major characters. I like Chris Cooper. I think this was well within his range to play this villainous oil guy. Clever editing in there too. That oil man of the year scene juxtaposed with the assassination sequence too is brilliant. I mean, this is what pays for this kind of event where we're congratulating each other. I understand completely why the people who were involved were involved. I mean, that's something I've admired about George Clooney, is he does movies that he does his Ocean's movies and the entertainment ones too, to pay the bills, but he also cares so much about global issues, and he will do some films that question how things are in the world. And this was a good choice for him, but I don't think this was George Clooney's movie. I think, as you said, this is the screenplays movie. I might say, I think if this had been, maybe it's an unfair thing to say, but if this had been directed by Steven Soderbergh, it might have been a little bit more focused.
You know what I think it is too? And this is some speculation on my part. I think there's scenes that got cut.
Well, and it's a long enough movie as it is. But
it is. And I wonder too, if someone like Soderbergh was on it, would he be able to make, like, no, I need this scene. I need it to be longer. Because I feel like, what's an example I can give you when I watch it? You mentioned the movie theater scene, you know, Clooney's character, Bob. He's talking with his ex-buddy, who's a contractor. And he's like, who's behind this? Like, who made the call? And they kind of lean over, and it's a further back shot. And you see him whisper in his ear, and he kind of looks at him. And then the next time we see him, he's stalking Christopher Plummer's character, for lack of a better word. And then we get the diner. And in my head, I'm like, there's got to be more connections. There's got to be a scene where he goes to a guy and then the guy leads him to Plummer. Like that feels like a bit of a leap to me. And I think in the interest of time and trying to cut it, we actually lose some clarity, is my guess.
I feel like it would be like a great short story collection, but if they keep jumping into the different stories, and then after a while, like story three, you're forgetting stuff or you're getting mixed up. I mean, I'm not sure I need this necessarily, but I would love something where you watch Matt Damon's arc and you just watch those scenes and try to piece that together. You watch Jeffrey Wright's arc, and you watch Clooney's arc, and you know, Chris Cooper's, and Plummer's, and you kind of see how that story works and get a little bit of clarity from that. But I think with this cutting in and out, I mean, I'm not sure I want it spoon-fed to me. I think that'd be criticizing it for being a little bit too much that way.
Right.
But I feel like it will lose a lot of audiences. Like I have trouble recommending this to a general audience unless they're really interested in these actors or this particular issue, because you're going to see it. You're not going to get everything. And I don't think a second or even a third viewing of it, you're going to be able to get everything. I think it requires regular rewatches, which a lot of people just don't necessarily have time for or want to do. But again, I almost feels like the theme of the show. The acting is so good in this movie, and the ideas are big, and it's serious, and there are consequences. I think this does a good job of staying grounded, like super realistic almost.
Yeah.
It doesn't have those melodramatic moments. And for what was kind of an Oscar bait movie at the time, you know, it didn't. I think Roger Ebert maybe had it really high, maybe number two on his top 10 list that year. Or,
yep.
High up there.
It's high on mine. Like, it was one of the movies that when it became available, I went out and I bought it for the home library. Yeah.
So I'm guessing it's probably points wise, it's going to do quite well for you. I'm glad that I've, you know, have the podcast now where I can rewatch and go back to some of the movies and realize, no, this is very clever. I just need to, you know, I need to keep returning to it because I was happy to watch it again. I knew this was one because I had watched it initially, and then I don't know. I tend to forget a lot of things. There's some movies I see, I remember every beat. This is not one where I remember every cast member, right, every beat, but there are certain key moments. And you mentioned, you know, that pool scene is so important. Matt Damon mapping the whole thing out in the desert too. Like, that's in the sand. That's a scene I remember so well.
And the diner scene is good. It's
parts of admission. You know,
yeah.
Just watch them and maybe. Yeah, maybe don't go in with like the critical mindset that I do. Just try to enjoy the ride.
but you're not wrong though, because you know Traffic was similar for some folks too. It's like, okay, now where are we? What am I supposed to get out of this? It's like, yeah, you know, a lot of that one was like, for lack of a better term, color coded in terms of the filters that they were using in terms of settings. You know, the blue and the warmth. Mm-hmm. Where this doesn't really have that kind of palette. But to your point, right, like the thing that we're shown at the very beginning of the movie is essentially this arms deal, and Clooney's character Bob clearly is like, well, I thought I was selling both of these to you, and like, well, who's that guy walking up with one bomb? It's like, well, it was good structure, good crafting. Like, the payoff is we know exactly what happens to it by the end. Like, that's what brings us to the end. So,
and I think that whole bit is brilliant because it gets forgotten about in all of everything.
Yeah, else. No one else is clocking it. We get to watch it as the audience.
That is the main thing. That is the main thing that's going
to
be.
And Bob is like, what about this thing? And he has to deal with all these other problems.
It's a great one. I think it just grows in my esteem. It reminds me of like my first reaction to the movie, The Thin Red Line. I don't think I got it the first time I saw it, but I kept wanting to go back to it and back to it and back to it. And every time I watch it, I appreciate that movie more and more. So
yeah, that's a great example.
You carry your gun, Mr. Chase?
I never bothered. Ruins the line of your suit.
You used to be a spy. My child is a prisoner.
$17 million. All they will take is eye, is ear, the hand. And don't tell me you don't have the money.
My former father-in-law only buys the best. Time for you to do whatever it is he pays you to do. Let's hope you're half as good as everything else he's bought.
We need to pay the ransom, Mr. Getty.
I do not have the money to spare.
No one has ever been richer than you are at this moment. What would it take for you to feel secure?
More.
More.
I'm gonna find your son.
Getty, baby,
you're protected from every threat. Unless that threat happens to be me.
Paul, I just want to go home.
Paul.
I didn't hire an ex-CIA officer just to pay people off.
Hey, Harvey.
required you to do things that other people can't or won't do.
We have to be willing to walk away.
He's my son. I can't walk away.
I don't think this is about money.
It's about power.
Power.
Business.
Terrible.
Family.
Tell him I'm coming.
Now the movie that you could argue Christopher Plummer saved.
Yeah.
You know.
And for doing so, here's one last Academy Award nomination. Yeah.
And it was, and it looked for a little while like it would get recognized in more categories. It was the only category was supporting actor for this film. It did quite well with Golden Globe nominations that year, but Ridley Scott's All the Money in the World. I'll start off with the behind-the-scenes stuff, and then we'll get to like the actual movie itself, which I think is a throwback to 1970s kidnapping thrillers, even though it is a true story. Yeah, about Getty's grandson, his namesake, Getty III, getting kidnapped in Italy, and the family dynamics, and, you know, this guy who is apparently the most wealthy person in the world, doesn't appear to be willing to pay the ransom to get his grandson back. And there's a whole lot of stuff behind that. But two big issues were, this was, you know, at the time of Me Too, and the accusations started to come out. And this was when Kevin Spacey, who I should say at this point, I think he's been cleared of all the trials and the charges, but there's obviously something there. I mean, the guy's, I don't think he's going to ever work in mainstream films again, but he had actually filmed the entire role, and they were about to release the film. They had their date, and they realized, if we release this film with Kevin Spacey in it, it's going to tank, because he was one of the first quote-unquote canceled actors, and with no notice whatsoever. And I think he was probably 87, almost 88 when he shot it, because it was just months, in fact even days, before it was to be released. They reshot all of the scenes with Christopher Plummer playing Kevin Spacey's role, and he gives a great performance. And I think it's that, must be that theater training or something, because he, right, rehearsal period, got on there and filmed it and just nailed it, and gives the best performance in the movie, in my opinion. The other thing that happened, again, this was kind of connected to Me Too, but also the inequities of pay became a major factor. This movie stars Michelle Williams and Mark Wahlberg, and it was released that Michelle Williams made a fraction of what Mark Wahlberg made on this film. Wahlberg, to his credit, took the equivalent amount of what he made, which is more than Michelle Williams, and he donated it to, I don't know if it was a shelter or to
I can't remember,
women's cause or something like that. But all of this is kind of happening, and the pay equity debate was brought forward in Hollywood and showing the inequities, which frankly still exist. But that became kind of a bit of a side thing with this film as well. What's lost a bit in this is that it's actually a pretty solid thriller. It's an epic. It's epic in scale. I think it's about 2.5 hour movie. Ridley Scott is another guy who likes to paint with a broad brush, like Michael Mann. He works a lot. He makes a lot of films. They're not all masterpieces. I think this would be in the middle of his filmography. I think I did an entire show on Ridley Scott. I think this is a solid Ridley Scott film. He's the right director for this material. I think he's maybe a little bit more comfortable in some of the more out there bits. There is like an ear that gets hacked off and some violence and those pieces there. And he's very good at the operatic moments. And there's some really operatic moments surrounding Getty and those scenes. I also think Michelle Williams is awesome in this film. You know, she's got kind of a Kennedy, Bostonian dialect. That might be a notch or two too big, but she's essentially a mother who's trying to get her son back. She is separated from the junior Getty, who has had a lot of problems in his life. And she's begging her former father-in-law to help. The payoff towards the end as to why he's not doing this is also just brilliant. And so I think this is kind of, in a way, It's a bit of a standard Hollywood action thriller, but its importance seemed to be a little bit more elevated, certainly because of the actors that they had in it and the fact that it's based on a true story, whether everything was exactly accurate or if they played up some
embellished bits. Embellished some stuff, maybe, yeah.
The kidnapping sequences and the lead up to that, very patient, very well done. And at the beginning, I think, perhaps for me, the weak link in the cast is Mark Wahlberg. He's playing one of his macho bravado characters, but he still seems, his line delivery seems a little bit wooden in places. He just seems outmatched by Michelle Williams, who's one of our best actors, I think. I just admire her so much. And certainly Plummer. I mean, I just think, but Michelle Williams and Christopher Plummer, their scenes are fantastic. And I think it's a really worthwhile film. I like it a lot, but this is one where I feel like my first impression was that I liked it quite a bit, even though I had some problems or nitpicky things here or there. But I've mentioned some other films that have kind of gotten a little bit better on multiple viewings for me.
Yeah.
I don't know if this movie, I don't think it's diminishing returns on multiple viewings, but it almost kind of stays the same. It's like within its wheelhouse, it's exactly what it is. It's not maybe as important as it was made out to be, but it's a solid film. I think if you're a fan of Ridley Scott, any of these actors, or you're curious, some people are just watch this movie because they're curious to see if there's any strain in the performances or what was shot during the Kevin Spacey time versus what was shot.
Well, I remember because they released a trailer with Spacey.
That's right, they did.
And I remember when it came out, I was like, wow, because of course he's like way younger than Getty was, so he's in all this makeup. And I remember seeing the trailer going, I don't know, man. I don't know if I'm gonna buy this.
Mm-hmm. It might have been a really bad performance from him.
Who knows, right? Like,
or a villain like nobody else, because perhaps he actually was a villain in real life. Yeah. I don't know.
And it was only shot in the movie when I watched it was that sequence that was from the trailer of him in that suit with the hand. He's out in the desert and he turns. That's the only one with Plummer where I kind of felt like, okay, that's some CGI. Like they did some mapping there where they tried to map him into the shot. Yeah. That was the only one where I was just like, okay, they probably couldn't go on location or whatever it might have been.
Like it was a big complex film to shoot, and the fact that they could get away with this,
that's what blew me away, to be honest. When I watched it, I'm like, this is way more scenes than I anticipated. Like in my head, I'm like, oh, these are the two main characters and he would have X number of scenes. Like no, like it's integral.
He's crucial to the whole thing. I mean, there's all of the other sequences, unfortunately. I mean, if it had been Mark Wahlberg, it would have been a bigger problem for them probably. They wouldn't have been able to release it on time. I mean, last time I saw it, I haven't been a chance to rewatch it this week, but last time I saw it, I was just like, Plummer is even better on a second watch than the first time I saw it. And I really admired what he did. It wasn't a given he was going to get that nomination that year. I think the Globes nominated him, but the SAG Awards didn't. And so I thought, well, he might be left off, but he got that nomination and was like, yes, please. I mean, look at what this guy did for this film. Like a selfless act. I mean, I'm sure he was paid and everything. He wasn't working for free. But at the same time, at his age, to take on something like that, that quickly and that intense a role. Well,
and, I mean, yeah, and that's a great point. I think that things that need to be, because we'll talk about like, oh, wow, De Niro did all the weight change for Raging Bull and Tom. You know, we talk about those things, about the time they put in. It's like, well, in this instance, I would say it would be just as impressive for someone to come in and like reshoot a bunch of scenes under the gun to try to get it out in time. Like, I think it is. I think it's a two factor thing going on. The performance, which is really, really solid, and the manner in which he gave it.
I wouldn't support that nomination if it wasn't a great performance, because it's a great performance on top of everything else. But the fact that story was out there just made it even more important. Yeah. It's fitting in a way. I thought we'd either talk at the end about Beginners, which he got his Oscar for. I would hate to call it a career Oscar because he's very good in Beginners, but I feel like that was a little bit of the motivation when he got that. I might argue he's better in this, but it's two different characters. One, as I said, is very, very subtle, and then this bigger than life supposed millionaire character. And
who invests everything for tax breaks.
Yeah, I know.
His net worth is high, but
such a snake. Such a snake. And this is where, I mean, Plummer can play a character that we really care about and we're in tears over in another film, over death scenes and different things that he's doing. And then he can be just the most awful person in the world in this. And it's equally brilliant. It's not news that this guy was one of our great actors, but this shows it off. And so I'm almost glad we're ending with this one, because that says a lot about him, that he was willing to come in here and do this and save this film, this rather expensive film for the studio. It was a studio film. It wasn't a small independent film. And for Ridley Scott and for all these people, it was remarkable. I mean, I think it's just a remarkable achievement. I forget who won that year, but I'll always think of that and like give them points. I mean, people in their late 80s or approaching 90s, I mean, I think it's tough to get through one day of shooting, you know, and here he's, you know, he's coming in and doing this, and he kept working and had, some credits after this. I think he had about 3 or 4 more credits after this movie came out. And yeah, he became the oldest, he was 88 when he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. So the oldest nominee in the history of the Academy Awards, and well-deserved. I'm talking a lot about Plummer, obviously, but how do you feel about the other aspects of the film? Do you agree about Wahlberg or?
Well, yeah, I like Mark Wahlberg in most things, but he's often Mark Wahlberg. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't feel very different from film to film. I was really happy to see Andrew, I don't know how you pronounce the last name for sure, but Buchan is who I assume. He's the husband. He's the second. John Paul Getty the second. Like, I was first introduced to him in Broadchurch when we watched that TV show. So it was really cool. Like, when he came out, oh my God, is that the guy from Broadchurch? And so that was like the one kind of nice surprise when I finally watched it. Yeah, Timothy Hutton's in there. And you know, that feels like a bit of a turn, right? Like, there's the things that kind of let me down in the film, generally, down the home stretch. Like, so I do know he died a few years after the events. And so the way it's edited kind of makes it feel like he was dying right at the time that this was all coming to a close. Well, it was a couple more years before he died.
Yeah, but the rescue was happening. Again, it's another one of those ones where they cut back and forth at the same time as he's,
And so then after that, so you know, Timothy Hutton's playing the big lawyer for John Paul Getty. And then it's like, but the king is dead, so now we need someone else. I'm like, that just felt like a weird turn to have this lawyer who was so adversarial for her to kind of be essentially the one going, but now we can make it all better. So that felt a bit weird. And I must admit, I'm a bit, I don't know, maybe I don't have to, maybe I'm overthinking it. But the last moment where I guess it's a picture, if you're distilling the whole thing down, it's actually a bit of a bargaining match back and forth between him, Getty, and Gail, the ex-daughter-in-law.
Yeah.
And so the last moment you get is like, well, she's inherited this stuff and she's looking at this bust of Getty. Like, that's the final moment. And I'm like, I don't know. I felt a bit more confused than anything. It didn't feel like an ending to me.
And where are we to take from this? Like, we're kind of, I think, cheering for her through most of the movie, but now
agreed.
Has she
been saddled with this huge responsibility? And so, I got you after death.
Or is this, his practical joke? I don't know. I think the idea they're playing with is that she proved that she could go toe to toe with him and that she was tough, and all the others would just lay down and just accept that, he wins. Yeah. She was relentless. And so that's the kind of person who should be now in charge of this empire. I don't know. I think probably rightly so. It didn't get much acknowledgement beyond Plummer's performance. Williams had some precursor nominations for lead actress. It's not her best performance, but I think she's still...
But she's given a lot of good ones, so it's kind of hard.
she doesn't typically... I think even in her teen roles, there's some horror movies that I went back and saw. It's like, oh yeah, that's right. It's young Michelle Williams. She's still interesting in those. She's right. So good. She can, but if I'm to go to a Michelle Williams film, My Week with Marilyn, or her supporting performance in Manchester by the Sea are ones that I'll go to before this one. But right. I mean, she goes toe to toe with Plummer And again, Plummer, and he's the there's many reasons to see this movie, but I think just to see that, I'd be curious, somebody who just saw the movie without knowing any of that history or any of the backstory, what they would think. If they think, right, that was good, might go a little bit long, but that was good, that was fine, but not,
yeah, or maybe they would say, yeah, that's great. But it did feel like a bit of a variation on, like, we didn't talk about it in this too, but, you know, the girl with the dragon tattoo,
was on my previous episode, yeah, similar type, you know, of character.
It feels a similar thing where, like, the older guy with a lot of money who's, you know, I think it was I'm sure he's not the only one, but Brian Dennehy, remember him saying there's three phases to an actor's career, and he used his own name as he told the story. He's like, who is Brian Dennehy? And then the second phase is, get me Brian Dennehy. And then, get me someone like Brian Dennehy, like, those are the things. And it just feels like the Plumber was in a bit of a phase here, and maybe all the power to him, and why something like maybe Beginners popped and stood out. And that might be another reason why it did, because it wasn't like, oh, the old rich power hungry guy with lots of money, good or bad. It was.
And the same as what you said is certainly true with Remember. I mean, that wasn't a high status, or, yeah, it's very hard for me not to talk about Remember without giving stuff away.
And stuff away. Yeah.
But yeah, there's a little bit of everything that's great about Christopher Plummer in that performance as well here. Yeah. But I feel like I'm more likely to rewatch this film than I am Remember. Yeah, I almost feel like it should be the reverse. I should be looking
right
at that one more often, because it's Canadian and it's a bit of a smaller film too. And so maybe the happy medium is Beginners. That's the one I can go to and get something. And nice.
That Jack Russell. That's right.
That Jack Russell. Yeah. You have to be a pretty well-trained dog to outdo Ewan McGregor and Christopher Plummer. All right. I think we're ready to do some points.
Where the hell's the rest?
Nebraska football fans voice their criticism.
You cut it. Coming up in Bernard Goldberg's America. You cut the guts out of what I said.
It was the time consideration.
Time? Bullshit. You corporate lackey. Who told you your incompetent little fingers have the requisite skills to edit me? I'm trying to band-aid a situation here, and you're too dim to...
Mike?
Try Mr. Wallace. We work in the same corporation doesn't mean we work in the same profession. Now, what are you going to do now? You're going to finesse me? Lawyer me some more? I've been in this profession 50 fucking years. You and the people you work for are destroying the most respected, the highest rated, the most profitable show on this network.
Guy, thank you so much for being back on the show. I've appreciated talking to you. Don't get to do it as much as I would like to, but I think I said in the last time you were on the show, I appreciate all the work that you are doing for theater across Canada, but certainly here in Saskatchewan, what you've done. And I've obviously... because I got to work with you for a little bit there in my university days, have followed your career and the cool projects. The fact that, like, I was growing up as a kid, the idea of the movie A Few Good Men was so important to me. And when I saw you got to direct A Few Good Men, I was just like, oh, that's awesome. And, like, the right person for the job. And so I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule, because you're one of the, you know, I mean, you're obviously a person that from all aspects, acting and producing and directing, you are busy and you are helping enrich the artistic community here, and also kind of pushing the envelope with projects which are sometimes not easy sells and are very worthwhile. So I think you've always been kind of a story guy, and that's why I like having you on the show, because, and sometimes if I was like, oh, I'm struggling with this one a little bit, Sky will have some insights to help. around to thinking
well
about
I can it. Tell you the pleasure is mine coming on, and I enjoy it, even though it's taken so long to get back to do a second one. I enjoy it because it makes me go back and either watch films that I haven't seen yet or rewatching ones that I long enjoyed. So
there were reasons I created this. I know I don't there aren't a million people who listen to my show, but I wanted to see movies that I have in my collection or otherwise I haven't seen in years, and be able to just connect with people and talk movies with them. And so it's just an honor and a pleasure to have you as a guest here. And now it's time. So I will say that, oddly enough, I don't physically own any of these movies, but this is the 80th episode where technically I'm supposed to get rid of half of them. So this might be at the end using your imagination about what I'm supposed to do at the end of this episode. But I'm curious to see how this goes. I don't think we were like disagreeing on a whole lot of stuff in this show. So
no, but sometimes that means though, like the difference between ones in the middle can be the difference between three and six.
It could be. It could be. I mean, especially if it's a good group. And last time we, of course, had five great movies. And yeah, even the one that I least like in here is still with an average list would probably be at the top. So we'll see how this goes here. But going in the order we reviewed them, how many points would you give Beginners?
I gave Beginners, giving like the point rank, I would give it 4 points.
The Insider.
6.
And Remember?
3.
And The Last Station.
1.
And Syriana?
5.
And All the Money in the World.
Would be 2.
Yeah, I think other than one, our points are different, but they're not much different in here. So this will be kind of interesting with the grand total. Beginners is one that I don't know. It started to become very personal to me in some ways. And the first time I saw it was to watch Plummer's performance.
Mm-hmm.
The second time, I kind of reached this age where I was really understanding Ewan McGregor and kind of like, you know, I'm surrounded by people all the time, but the themes of loneliness connected to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to put myself in the mindset of where if I was in this guy's situation, how would I be feeling? And that kind of brought out some emotions the second time I saw it. So it went up higher when I first put the show together. I thought it might be in the middle, but it was 5 points for me. We agree at the top here. The Insider, 6 points. Remember, I've had trouble with this one. And so sadly, it's 1 point for me for Remember. The Last Station, 2 points. I think I liked The Last Station more the first time, but second time I saw it and was a little bit more critical of what I was seeing. It looks good, but there's some problems. Syriana jumped up way higher than I expected it to. Again, I thought it'd become maybe in the 2 or 3, but 4 for it. All the Money in the World in the middle, a 3. I think it's kind of a good action thriller, and it has a really interesting backstory off camera. It's probably more interesting than the film itself, but it was just kind of in the middle for me. So the big winner, not surprisingly, is Michael Mann's The Insider at 12 points. Then we have a tie for second with Beginners and Syriana with 9 points. And fourth place is All the Money in the World with 5. And then fifth place is Remember with 4. And the very bottom is The Last Station with 3. So based on this definition, if I had physical copies of all of these, I would be losing The Last Station, Remember, and All the Money in the World. So given those films and that information, and since I don't have a movie to like physically get rid of, and I'm not smart enough to figure out how to digitally get rid of movies, what's something that I should do?
Within the next week, rewatch Remember one more time.
Yeah, give it another. Because
it's funny, I did a side thing, and I won't put you on the spot, but if you want to take a shot at it, I then also did, what do I think were the better Christopher Plummer performances?
I thought of that, we maybe
within these films, and Remember was my top of my list, even though I didn't think
performances
of these six. It wasn't my favorite film, but yeah. Remember was my favorite performance. And then, you know, not that I thought he was bad in any of them. I should just say that right out of the gate. I thought he was great in all of them. But yeah. Performances, I thought Remember was my strongest. And then Beginners, because it was so different from the rest. Even though it was supporting, he was amazing in The Insider. And then I like All the Money in the World, Last Station, and then Syriana. In part because it was just a smaller version of stuff that he was doing in some of the other films, it felt like.
Here's my on-the-spot rank, if you will,
of
the performances. For me, I think The Insider would actually be my favorite. One. Yeah. And then All the Money in the World would be 2. And then Beginners would be 3. 4 would be Remember. 5 would be Syriana. I just think The Last Station, there's nothing wrong with what he does, but I just think it's well within his wheelhouse, and it felt very big. Not as big as what Helen Mirren was doing. That said, I'm glad he was kind of acknowledged by the Academy a few times before he died, because I don't think he got that attention earlier in his career when he was doing some great work as well.
Yeah, agreed.
Anyway, thank you again. Are there any projects or any upcoming things that you'd like to promote?
Well, I'm going to be doing the Shakespeare and the Saskatchewan Festival this summer. So after being away directing out of province last summer, it'll be good to be back. And then the previous summer was my first time acting at the new site, but it was in Iago Speaks, Daniel McDonald's premiere. So I actually haven't had a chance to do Shakespeare on the new site yet. So I'm actually, that's part of the reason why I'm really looking forward to this year. So I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna get to do Shakespeare this time around. So that'll be in the summer.
Get to stay close to home for a few months too,
which is nice.
Again, I'm excited to continue to live vicariously through.
Well, I enjoy the chats and I enjoy texting and messaging and
yeah, for sure. Yeah. And we'll obviously have you on again, and you can think of some idea. I'm now starting to pare the show down into maybe two or three reviews as well to make it a little bit more manageable for busy folks to be able to be on the show on a more regular basis, but still kind of keep that idea of doing the points and kind of seeing if I can. I'm not paring down my collection as fast as I thought I would. It's increased quite a bit. So because that movie will work well with that theme. Huh? I might as well buy that.
Yeah. You're buying just to give something away.
Anyway, that's kind of how it's worked there. But before we go, shout out to Friendly Podcast. Obviously, Larry Parsons, Rank and Review. I would imagine, I'm not sure how many Marvel movies you have before your next.
Yeah, I'll have to take a look because I know we haven't talked, because I think we finished with Thor, Love and Thunder, and Wakanda Forever. I can't remember what the order was. Yeah, Wakanda Forever. We haven't had Ant-Man and Quantumania and Wasp. We haven't talked. Marvels is out, and I haven't Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. So a couple more.
Probably three more releases before we get the next.
The thing that's going to be tricky, and I'm just thinking of this on the spot, is we haven't done any of the Deadpool ones before because they haven't been part of the MCU. But with Deadpool and Wolverine coming out. Well, we eventually have to go back and watch the other Deadpools.
Of the X-Men movies, too. You throw that in. Yeah. And then you go back to, you know, Blade. I mean, there's all the – yeah, it's a big undertaking that you and Larry have.
Yeah, I don't think we realized what we've signed up for when we said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if
– They kept making more and more of them. But I really enjoy listening to those shows there and Larry's – program, Matt's show Film Feast, Lindsay's show Schlock and Awe, and Kurt Fitzpatrick's show A Lifetime of Hallmark and Lifetime Movies. They always say they are doing God's work on that show. But the show's hilarious. You know, you should check it out if you get a chance there. But just again to the listeners, thank you so much for supporting the show, and please be safe, take care of yourselves there, and keep supporting the movies. And until next time, thank you so much.